So our next paper of the month, Matt Galsky, Nature Medicine. Matt, friend of the show. Matt, do you want to introduce yourself and just talk very briefly about this, the paper that you wrote?
Sure. Thank you. So I'm Matt Galsky. I'm a medical oncologist at Mount Sinai in New York, where I focus on bladder cancer. And this study is an investigator-initiated study that we designed in around 2016. It has a 16 number. So we designed it 2016, but I don't think it opened until 2018. In this study involved giving cisplatin-based chemotherapy, GemCis, plus nivolumab in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And really, the study intended to determine whether or not transurethral resection of bladder tumor, TURBT, plus chemotherapy, plus immune checkpoint blockade could potentially be curative in a subset of patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer without needing cystectomy or other definitive local therapy. And there's lots of data that sort of led up to that point, but that's what the study was seeking to do.
And Matt, just to jump in, first of all, I think this might be at least your second or third paper of the month. So that's a record for the show. Congratulations.
There's no bias, by the way, in who's the selection process is extremely rigorous. I have to tell you, there are various rounds and committee
members. I don't think anything we do is rigorous, and, but yes. My question is around, you mentioned
we disagree rigorously. I think we disagree.
I guess seven, eight years ago when you designed it. And I remember maybe hearing some of these concepts at the time and thinking, boy, it's pretty brave not to take muscle invasive patients to cystectomy. What was that conversation like at the time? Was there resistance from investigators or maybe patients or not?
So I think there was a healthy level of concern and skepticism. You know, this is not a standard approach. So I think definitely a healthy level of criticism, maybe comment and criticism. From our colleagues and from investigators who were involved in the study, which of course helped with the design of the study. From a patient standpoint, I have not participated in a study that accrued more rapidly than this study. Hmm. I think patients sort of told us what they wanted with this study. And of course, it selected for a group of patients who were looking for a strategy that was different. And I think we all encounter these patients. But yes, it was certainly a departure from what was being done.
Matt, so six cycles of Gem, Cis with Nevo, and then I think it was eight cycles of Nevo by itself.
Four cycles up front and then eight.
Right? Oh, sorry, I apologize. Four, of course, not eight. What am I talking about? At that point, that completion point, you assess for complete response, but clearly complete response traditionally has looked at pathological complete response with cystectomy, and you came up with a hybrid system. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, TURBT plus systemic therapy, as you know, has been pursued as a definitive treatment in the past. There's data, going back 30 years. Most of that data is single center. Most of it is retrospective. And so we know that some patients can get away with this approach, but the real question is, who are those patients and can we really define that in a more rigorous way? So we thought that there were a few barriers to pursuing this type of strategy historically, and the trial was really designed to overcome those barriers. And one of those barriers was the fact that we just don't define and measure clinical response consistently in this population of patients. So we wanted to know what the clinical complete response rate was, but we had to define that very rigorously in order to determine the performance characteristics of clinical complete response. So patients underwent a repeat cystoscopy, biopsy of any visible tumor, of course. If there was no visible tumor, there was a biopsy of the prior resection site and biopsies in a template within the bladder. There was urine cytology and there was cross-sectional imaging, and we recommended MRI unless MRI was contraindicated. We got MRI from the majority of patients. All of those assessments had to be normal to qualify as a clinical complete response. No evidence of tumor on visibly, nothing microscopically, negative cytology, normal imaging. I'll say that the imaging part, we had to include a little bit of a hedge in that, of course, after TUR and systemic therapy, there can be some residual thickness in the bladder. So that's not completely straightforward. But we requested that that investigators consider the imaging in the context of those other results.
You didn't use circulating tumor DNA. I guess it was prior to that kind of explosion that was just happening at the moment. And we didn't use urine tumor DNA, you use urine cytology. With hindsight, would you go back and look at circulating tumor DNA? Would you incorporate that into your definition of complete response?
So I think in order to do that, certainly we need data, sort of retrospective data in this context. And so that data is being generated from this study and in some other studies. And I think, yes, I think by all means, in the future, we need to do that. But it would be nice to base that on some data.
Yeah, the clinical CR definition, was there, do you think it's sort of set? Like you defined it at the beginning, it worked well. We could talk about the outcomes in a second. Or do you think that's something that will evolve? Putting the ctDNA question aside for a second, I mean, evolve with imaging or PET scanning or, I don't know, you know, is it set or is that something you think needs more work?
I mean, I think the MRI component could certainly be refined and people are working on this. I think MRI worked well, but there are nuances to the imaging as discussed. And I think our, you know, radiology colleagues can really try and refine that in a way that the interpretation is much more consistent.
Matt, the results, you showed a 43% complete response rate. You recruited, was it 78 patients? Correct me if I'm wrong, about 78, or around that number. 43% CR rate. I guess the pathological CR rate for neoadjuvant chemotherapy with an immune checkpoint inhibition, somewhere between 35 and 45%. So very much in line with what one might expect had one performed a cystectomy. And then with this population, you went on, and a relatively few of these patients who achieved this goal of CR relapsed. So obviously it was a good result. How did you feel about the clinical result and how do you take this forwards?
So in terms of just terminology, so, you know, a pathologic complete response, of course, is defined by cystectomy. Clinical complete response involves pathology. It involves a biopsy, but that's clinical. That's clinical response. That's not pathological response. And sometimes people confuse those terms. So one of our goals was to define the performance of clinical complete response for a longer term outcome, an outcome that would be more relevant to patients, because just achieving a clinical complete response alone, of course, is not that important. It's what does that mean in terms of that patient's journey? And so a co-primary endpoint of the study was to define the positive predictive value of clinical complete response for two-year metastases-free survival. And the reason we chose 2 years metastases-free survival is because of this issue about the disconnect between clinical complete response and pathological complete response. We recognize that there is some disconnect there, but we don't think that's the most important question. The more important question is, in a subset of patients who have a clinical complete response who later develop recurrence in the bladder, can those patients effectively undergo cystectomy at that time and not have their cancer control compromised? Because if that's the case, then using clinical complete response for decision-making becomes a viable strategy. So of the 33 patients with a clinical complete response, 33 out of 76 patients, of those 33, 32 opted to defer cystectomy. One opted for immediate cystectomy. Of those 32 who opted to defer cystectomy, 8 patients have developed local recurrence and underwent later cystectomy. Of that group, only one patient has developed metastatic disease. So of those 32, one patient developed metastatic disease during follow-up, sort of an unusual situation that I can describe. And no patients have died in that group. So we think that clinical complete response as defined in this protocol does correlate with more important long-term outcomes. But of course, this needs to be validated in other data sets and larger studies.
And Matt, what would you expect if you had, a 43% clinical complete response, if that was a pathologic response as standardly defined? I mean, you'd probably expect similar numbers or more patients to develop metastatic disease, right?
We know that in patients with a path CR, the five-year survival is about 90%, right?
So yeah,
we do know right. Some of those patients develop metastatic disease.
Yeah.
Matt, last clinical question. What evidence do you have that nivolumab has added anything to this beyond just giving four cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy and stopping and the responders there?
So when we designed the study, we thought that, of course, based on what the data that was emerging in other solid tumors, that chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint blockade was going to be a sort of no-brainer. So we thought that at the very least, there would be independent drug action in non-cross resistance, and so some benefit there. Obviously, the story has taken some turns since then. One or two. Although we do know in the metastatic setting that the same exact regimen in CheckMate 901, gem cis nevo and metastatic disease versus gem cis, leads to higher response rates and higher clinical complete response rates in the metastatic setting. So I think it adds something based on that data. But of course, this is a single arm study.
Matt, we're going to move to the biomarker piece in 1 second. But just before we get there, two or three questions around the clinical piece. Do you think in this environment, in the neoadjuvant setting, and we've got 7 prospective randomized neoadjuvant trials, we've got EV Pembro trials, we've got EV Durva-Tremi trials, we've got cisplatin eligible trials, we've got cisplatin ineligible trials, we've got single agent Pembro trials, we've got chemo plus duvalumab, chemo plus pembrolizumab, and chemo plus nivolumab. In this neoadjuvant space, we are giving neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy to unselected patients. Do you think that's the right approach? Or do you think your tailor-made type approach, where not everyone gets cystectomy, and dare I say it, not everyone gets adjuvant therapy, is that a better approach? Have we got this whole thing wrong? That's the question I'm asking.
In summary.
I think we clearly over-treat patients and we under-treat patients. And that's one of the major challenges of oncology, right? That we don't know which patients we over-treat and we under-treat. So I think we have to continue to develop these types of strategies in parallel. And ideally, the tools will be better and better over time. And I think we're seeing that with ctDNA. I'm certainly very enthusiastic that's in the perioperative setting. That's going to shift paradigms. I think the technology gets better and better so that we learn how which patients need to undergo cystectomy and which patients don't.
Okay, so the first question, your answer is yes, we need some refinement and the one size fits all approach, not ideal. Question number two, we've got the adjuvant pembrolizumab data coming up at GWASCO in a couple of weeks' time. We don't know the results of that study. We do know the progression-free survival is positive in a press release, and we know OS is ongoing. We don't know if we're going to see the OS or not. I certainly hope we will see the OS. If we were, we won't have that debate today, Matt.
Here we go again.
If we were seeing OS, if the OS came in, let's say, preliminary at 0.56, you might remember adjuvant renal cancer, adjuvant Pembro came in immature in the 0.6s or 0.53. If that was trending in the right direction, would that mean the pembrolizumab data was more robust than the nivolumab data? And the same, so that's question one. And question two is, if the OS comes in, and let's say it comes in at 1.0, showing absolutely nothing, does that mean this whole adjuvant space with all of these drugs is a bust?
So I guess to take the second part first, no, I don't think it's a bust, because I think that, your retrospective data, if for lack of a better term, I don't remember if that was.
By retrospective, it's fine. I'm happy with that.
Yeah. So your ctDNA data, right? If you believe that, then you believe that adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade works. You just believe that you need to define patients who actually have micrometastatic disease. So it's not that the treatment doesn't work, it's that the wrong patients are selected for the treatment. And so I think most of the data goes in that same direction, right? We have two studies that show a PFS benefit and one that didn't, but if you look at the subset of patients at high risk, then you see it. So I think regardless of OS or not, there is a benefit to the treatment based on the studies that we have so far. Now, whether or not patients need treatment in the adjuvant setting or can wait until they develop recurrence, I think that's where it's possible that we need to refine who we're treating by using tools to do that. And I think we'll see once we see overall survival data from Ambassador and from 901, we'll see what the story is there.
But, and so, Matt, I mean, back to your paper, you could envision then in your approach, patients with clinical CR, but perhaps ctDNA positive could get adjuvant therapy, and those that are clinical CR and ctDNA negative could be observed. Is that a reasonable conclusion?
I think it's a reasonable conclusion, but I would say perhaps that, there's a very interesting question related to that, which is that, so say you give systemic therapy after TUR, and a patient has still detectable ctDNA, but a clinical complete response, there is the question about whether or not that patient should undergo a cystectomy or that patient absolutely shouldn't undergo a cystectomy.
Right, right.
You know, we definitely see patients who have detectable ctDNA where it clears with cystectomy alone. So this notion that detectable ctDNA when a tumor is in place in the bladder, this notion that absolutely represents metastatic disease that has clinical implications, I think we need more data. It's possible that those patients can still be cured with cystectomy and that shedding of tumors from that primary tumor.
Matt, I agree with that. I think, and I think urine circulating DNA, or urine tumor DNA has a role to play. Coming back to the original question, the Pembro-Nevo question, if adjuvant Pembro has OS trending strongly in the right direction, but not yet mature, would that supersede nivolumab, assuming the PFS were the same? Would that OS trend that you have for one drug and not for the other, would that mean you'd be selecting the drug with the OS trend, or would you see them as interchangeable?
I would see them as interchangeable. I mean, I think that you're
still not. So we still don't need OS.
Well, I think
like, myself.
That's because it refused to come on the show again. If you keep badgering him about it.
No, he's won paper of the month. It's one of the honors of a lifetime. Of course, he's going to appear on the show.
your question would be probably a really important question if we had OS data from 901, but we haven't seen it yet. So it's I think once we see the data from both studies, then that's going to be a key question.
Matt, let's move to the excellent biomarker work that you did. We know a little bit about biomarkers in urothelial cancer, but not as much as we'd like. I think the story so far is that PD-L1 as a biomarker, tumor and immune component, hasn't lived up to our initial hopes and has let us down more times than it's helped us. There is TMB, which in exploratory analysis seems to be encouraging, but we've never really taken it forward aggressively. We've shown some gene signatures, particularly immune gene signatures, correlating with response, T effector type signatures. And then there are a whole series of other exploratory biomarkers. In this work, you looked at mutations and you looked for responses to chemotherapy, genes looking for response to chemotherapy and the immune therapy component of this. But you also did some really elegant work on PBMCs. Do you want to just talk a bit about what those two experiments showed and how they helped us?
Sure. So we had a pretty naive hypothesis when we designed the study, which was that if there are tumors with mutations in DNA damage response and repair genes, then those tumors might also have a higher TMB, in which case they might be optimal patients, or they might be tumors that are exquisitely sensitive to both cisplatin-based chemotherapy and that was sort of the hypothesis. So if we define patients with DDR alterations, then those might be the patients who absolutely did the best with this regimen. We used a predefined signature of genes, which when mutated, others have shown predict sensitivity to cisplatin-based chemotherapy, work done by Ellie Van Allen, Jonathan Rosenberg, Betsy Plimack, and others. So using that approach, we asked the question whether or not added to clinical complete response, mutations in those genes help the positive predictive value for these longer term outcomes? Do they add to it? Because if you can use clinical complete response alone, then you know the genomics don't really help you that much. And what we showed was that the mutations in those genes actually weren't that helpful in this situation. Once you had clinical complete response, that trumped the genomic information. Now that can be misinterpreted. So we're not saying that those mutations do not confer sensitivity to cisplatin-based chemotherapy or immune checkpoint blockade. In fact, patients with ERCC2 mutations or patients with an increased TMB had a higher likelihood of a clinical complete response. The problem is that it didn't add beyond if you had a clinical complete response in one of those mutations, it didn't predict for a better long-term outcome. So I think, you know, sort of a simplistic way of looking at that is that if you know the future, predicting the future isn't that helpful, right? So knowing that someone's going to be...
That's a great quote.
Yeah. Knowing that someone's going to have a higher likelihood of a response doesn't help you that much once they've already had a response. So that's the genomic data. The other data that we did in, you know, there's a whole host of additional tissue-based data that we've been working on for quite a long time. But in this paper, we included PBMC-based data, and we really looked at two approaches. One was CyTOF and the PBMC's baseline and then on treatment. And then we looked at multi-analyte proteomic platform called Olink. And so long story short from those assays, if you have higher measures of circulating CD4 cells at baseline, you do better with this treatment. If you have higher on-treatment levels of CD8s, then you do better. And then if you look at the Olink signature, there was a signature of three analytes, trail, fast ligand, and CD244, which sort of together imply either adaptive immunity or NK cell mediated immunity. If those go up cycle 3 day 1, then you do better. In terms of analytes suggestive of worse outcome, high baseline IL-6 predicted for poor outcomes, and an incredibly consistent observation across data sets, across solid tumors. And so that biology we've been interested in for quite a long time.
So Matt, my question, follow-up question then, just to go back a bit, are there any selection tools before you know the outcome, be they clinical or radiographic or biomarker, that would allow you to select patients for this approach? And maybe the follow-on question then is, you know, what happens from here? Are you doing this in your practice? Is there a larger study? Does it get adopted, or where do we go?
So no predictive biomarkers that we could identify that sort of have legs to test prospectively based on this study to date. We are not doing this as a standard approach. We have a second generation clinical trial, and then the third generation clinical trial has sort of been approved in hopefully will get up and running within the next 6 months. The second generation clinical trial involves immune checkpoint blockade alone. And really the basis for that design is that the path CR rates with single agent neoadjuvant immune checkpoint blockade seem pretty similar to what's achieved with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So to extend this type of approach to a larger population of patients, including patients who are older, that we move forward with that second generation study. That design's a little bit different, and it includes chemoradiation in patients who don't have a clinical complete response. So it's really built to for a population of patients who might not be ideal candidates for cystectomy and are really looking for something else. There are, of course, a number of other similar studies looking at a similar question, including those being led by Betsy Plimack's group, and there's the Alliance study being led by Go Bayer. And I think that looking at all of these studies together is really going to define whether or not a phase 3 study with this approach is the right thing to do, and if so, what's going to be the right regimen and design.
Matt, where do we go with biomarkers in urothelial cancer, not circulating biomarkers? Let's base around is there a future for tissue-based biomarkers, or have we come to the end of the road?
I think there's a future, of course, and we need to keep pursuing it. But, you know, I think I might have said this on the podcast before, but I think that, you know, we're probably going to be more successful identifying biomarkers of patients who need treatment versus patients who benefit from treatment, because the patients who biomarkers of benefit, of course, can be much more heterogeneous because benefit is defined very heterogeneously. Biomarkers of patients who need treatment, you either have micrometastatic disease or you don't. And so one could define that probably simplistically from both a biomarker development standpoint and a clinical utility standpoint.
And give a shout out to Matt Yarning from our group at ASCO. He's from the Abacus trial. He's looked at ctDNA, and he's also looked at tumor-based biomarkers, and he's looked at the ctDNA positive patients and tried to incorporate tumor-based biomarkers in the patients that we know are at risk, and tried to identify patients that are more likely to respond or be resistant to two cycles of neoadjuvant atezolizumab. And I think some of his results are kind of, you know, it increases the accuracy of some of the biomarkers, because clearly if you're dragging along a whole lot of patients who are not going to ever be in harm's way, their biomarker is going to dilute your result. So I think that's quite a little interesting, and I'm looking forward to that. Matt, I've got three questions for you. My last question, of course. Number one, who in your practice now, frontline metastatic disease, who's getting EV Pembro, who's getting cisplatin Nevo, and who's getting maintenance of avelumab?
So I would say the vast majority of patients who are untreated with metastatic disease are getting EV Pembro. That's the majority of patients I've seen in the past couple of months.
Can I follow up on that then?
Yeah.
Let's say someone had adjuvant Nevo and progressed 3 months after completion of adjuvant Nevo. What are you giving them?
So I haven't had the three-month situation come up, but I have had the six-month and one-year situation come up. And in those patients, I am giving EV Pembro.
Sorry, Brian, you go.
No, I was just going to say, is that a cutoff then, 6 months, or just because that's what you've encountered in practice?
That's just what I've encountered in practice. I have had probably at least one patient who progressed on immune checkpoint blockade who I have not given the combination.
And Max, what's your experience of sequencing after EV Pembro? Are you giving platinum-based chemotherapy, or are you going to sequence other ADCs or FGFR inhibition?
So far, I've given other ADCs, but my experience in that specific situation is quite limited so far.
Fabulous.
Last quick question, just to go back to the neoadjuvant or perioperative space. I mean, it seems like with more active drugs and better tools and ctDNA that we're moving towards, maybe over the next, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, less cystectomy, right? I mean, do you think we're going to look back on cystectomy and say, wow, that was a barbaric operation that we were doing to a whole lot of people who maybe didn't need it? But obviously now with more drugs, I mean, is that true? Do you think we're moving towards that, or is that premature?
I think we're moving toward it. I think that's what patients want. I think we have to be very careful as you know, the comments that opened this discussion. I think we still have to be very, very careful how we proceed. But I think that is an approach for the future.
A reasonable ambition would be to reduce cystectomy by 90%, 90. I think that would be reasonable. And I don't see radiotherapy as the standard alternative to it. I think we need to do better than that with biomarkers and neoadjuvant systemic therapies. But I can see us being in a position where we can do that. I'm also quite excited, and I'm sure you know I've talked about this before, but you know, the Prexel, the TAR-200, TAR-210 program, local release of systemic therapy, I think that looks attractive as well. So I think there's a revolution going to take place, and I know it's not at ASCO GU, but I'm hoping within the too distant future, some of these randomized phase 3 neoadjuvant trials are going to read out. I personally think they're going to be positive. And obviously I think the EV Pembro neoadjuvant trials are going to be very positive. So I think I hope there's going to be a revolution in the neoadjuvant space. And I think, Matt, your approach, this, your bladder sparing approach, while it's single arm and it's relatively small and all the caveats that go with that, I think this is a really important step in that direction. So congratulations on your paper.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate you joining.
See you soon.
See you soon.
Thanks for having me. See you soon.